This is Audible.
Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of Forever Peace by Joe Haldeman, narrated by George Wilson. This work is copyrighted 1997 by Joe Haldeman. This recording is copyrighted 2000 by Recorded Books, Incorporated. Joe Haldeman opens this book with a quote from Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., "Man was born into barbarism when killing his fellow man was a normal condition of existence. He became endowed with a conscience, and he has now reached the day when violence toward another human being must become as abhorrent as eating another's flesh." And now, Forever Peace.
It was not quite completely dark. Thin blue moonlight threading down through the canopy of leaves, and it was never completely quiet. A thick twig popped, the noise muffled under a heavy mass. A male howler monkey came out of his drowse and looked down. Something moved down there, black on black. He filled his lungs to challenge it. There was a sound like a piece of newspaper being torn. The monkey's midsection disappeared in a dark spray of blood and shredded organs. The body fell heavily through the branches, in two halves.
"Would you lay off the goddamn monkeys?"
"Shut up."
"This place is an ecological preserve."
"My watch, shut up. Target practice." Black on black, it paused, then slipped through the jungle like a heavy, silent reptile. A man could be standing 2 yards away and not see it. In infrared, it wasn't there. Radar would slither off its skin. It smelled human flesh and stopped. The prey maybe 30 meters upwind, a male, rank with old sweat, garlic on his breath. Smell of gun oil and smokeless powder residue. It tested the direction of the wind and backtracked, circled around. The man would be watching the path, so come in from the woods. It grabbed the man's neck from behind and pulled his head off like an old blossom. The body shuddered and gurgled and crapped. It eased the body down to the ground and set the head between its legs.
"Nice touch."
"Thanks." It picked up the man's rifle and bent the barrel into a right angle. It lay the weapon down quietly and stood silent for several minutes. Then 3 other shadows came from the woods, and they all converged on a small wooden hut. The walls were beaten down aluminum cans nailed to planks. The roof was cheap glued plastic. It pulled the door off, and an irrelevant alarm sounded as it switched on a headlight brighter than the sun. 6 people on cots, recoiling.
"Do not resist," it boomed in Spanish. "You are prisoners of war and will be treated according to the terms of the Geneva Convention."
"Mierda!"
A man scooped up a shaped charge and threw it at the light. The tearing paper sound was softer than the sound of the man's body bursting. A split second later, it swatted the bomb like an insect, and the explosion blew down the front wall of the building and flattened all the occupants with concussion. The black figure considered its left hand. Only the thumb and first finger worked, and the wrist made a noise when it rotated.
"Good reflexes."
"Oh, shut up." The other 3 shapes turned on sunlights and pulled off the building's roof and knocked down the remaining walls. The people inside looked dead, bloody and still. The machines began to check them, though, and a young woman suddenly rolled over and raised the laser rifle she'd been concealing. She aimed it at the one with the broken hand and did manage to raise a puff of smoke from its chest before she was shredded. The one checking the bodies hadn't even looked up.
"No good," it said. "All dead, no tunnels, no exotic weapons I can find."
"Well, we got some stuff for Unit 8.
They turned off their lights and sped off simultaneously in 4 different directions. The one with the bad hand moved about a quarter mile and stopped to inspect the damage with a dim infrared light. It beat the hand against its side a few times. Still, only the two digits worked.
Wonderful. We'll have to bring it in.
So what would you have done?
Who's complaining? I'll spend part of my 10 in base camp.
The four of them took four different routes to the top of a treeless hill. They stood in a row for a few seconds, arms upraised, and a cargo helicopter came in at treetop level and snatched them away.
"Who got the second kill there?"
thought the one with the broken hand.
A voice appeared in all four heads. Berryman initiated the response, but Hogarth commenced firing before the victim was unambiguously dead, so by the rules they share the kill.
The helicopter with the four soldier boys dangling slipped down the hill and screamed through the night at treetop level, in total darkness, east toward friendly Panama.
I didn't like Scoville having the soldier boy before me. You have to monitor the previous mechanic for 24 hours before you take it over to warm up and become sensitive to how the soldier boy might have changed since your last shift, like losing the use of three fingers. When you're in the warm-up seat, you're just watching. You're not jacked into the rest of the platoon, which would be hopelessly confusing. We go in strict rotation, so the other nine soldier boys in the platoon also have replacements breathing over their mechanic's shoulders. You hear about emergencies where the replacement has to suddenly take over from the mechanic. It's easy to believe. The last day would be the worst even without the added stress of being watched. If you're going to crack or have a heart attack or stroke, it's usually on the 10th day. Mechanics aren't in any physical danger, deep inside the operations bunker in Portobello, but our death and disability rate is higher than the regular infantry. It's not bullets that gets us, though. It's our own brains and veins. It would be rough for me or any of my mechanics to replace people in Scoville's platoon, though. They're a hunter-killer group, and we're harassment and interdiction. H and I. Sometimes loaned to psychops. We don't often kill. We aren't selected for that aptitude. All 10 of our soldier boys came into the garage within a couple of minutes. The mechanics jacked out, and the exoskeleton shells eased open. Scoville's people climbed out like little old men and women, even though their bodies had been exercised constantly and adjusted for fatigue poisons. You still couldn't help feeling as if you'd been sitting in the same place for 9 days. I jacked out. My connection with Scoville was a light one, not at all like the near telepathy that links the 10 mechanics in the platoon. Still, it was disorienting to have my own brain to myself. We were in a large white room with 10 of the mechanic shells and 10 warm-up seats, like fancy barber chairs. Behind them, the wall was a huge backlit map of Costa Rica, showing with lights of various colors where soldier boy and fly boy units were working. The other walls were covered with monitors and digital readouts with jargon labels. People in white fatigues walked around checking the numbers. Scoville stretched and yawned and walked over to me. "Sorry you thought that last bit of violence was unnecessary. I felt the situation called for direct action."
God, Scoville and his academic airs. Doctorate in leisure arts.
"You usually do. If you'd warned them from outside, they would have had time to assess the situation. Surrender." "Yes, indeed, as they did in Ascension."
That was one time. We'd lost 10 soldier boys and a fly boy to a nuclear booby trap.
"Well, the second time won't be on my watch. 6 fewer Pedros in the world."
He shrugged.
"I'll go light a candle."
10 minutes to calibration," a loudspeaker said. Hardly enough time for the shell to cool down. I followed Scoville into the locker room. He went to one end to get into his civvies. I went to the other end to join my platoon.
Sarah was already mostly undressed. Julian, you want to do me?
Yes, like most of our males and one female, I did, as she well knew. But that's not what she meant. She took off her wig and handed me the razor. She had 3 weeks' worth of fine blonde stubble. I gently shaved off the area surrounding the input at the base of her skull.
That last one was pretty brutal, she said. Scoville needed the body count, I guess.
It occurred to him. He's 11 short of making E8. Good thing they didn't come across an orphanage.
He'd be bucking for captain, she said.
I finished her, and she checked mine, rubbing her thumb around the jack.
Smooth, she said.
I keep my head shaved off duty, though it's unfashionable for black men on campus. I don't mind long, bushy hair, but I don't like it well enough to run around all day wearing a hot wig. Lewis came over.
Hi, Julian. Give me a buzz, Sarah.
She reached up. He was 6'4", and Sarah was small, and he winced when she turned on the razor.
Let me see that, I said.
His skin was slightly inflamed on one side of the implant.
Lou, that's going to be trouble. You should have shaved before the warm-up.
Maybe. You gotta choose. Once you were in the cage, you were there for 9 days. Mechanics with fast-growing hair and sensitive skin, like Sarah and Lou, usually shaved once between warm-up and the shift.
It's not the first time, he said. I'll get some cream from the medics.
Bravo Platoon got along pretty well. That was partly a matter of chance, since we were selected out of the pool of appropriate draftees by body size and shape to fit the platoon's cages and the aptitude profile for H&I. 5 of us were survivors of the original draft pick, Candy and Mel, as well as Lou, Sarah, and me. We've been doing this for 4 years, working 10 days on and 20 off.
Seems like a lot longer.
Candy is a grief counselor in real life. The rest of us are academics of some stripe. Lou and I are science. Sarah is American politics, and Mel is a cook. Food science, so-called, but a hell of a cook. We get together a few times a year for a banquet at his place in St. Louis. We went together back to the cage area.
Okay, listen up, the loudspeaker said. We have damage on units 1 and 7, so we won't calibrate the left hand and right leg at this time.
So we need the cocksuckers? Lou asked.
No, the drains will not be installed, if you can hold it for 45 minutes.
I'll certainly try, sir.
We'll do the partial calibration, and then you're free for 90 minutes, maybe 2 hours, while we set up the new hand and leg modules for Julian and Candy's machines. Then we'll finish the calibration and hook up the orthotics, and you're off to the staging area.
Be still, my heart, Sarah murmured.
We lay down in the cages, working arms and legs into stiff sleeves, and the techs jacked us in. For the calibration, we were tuned down to about 10% of a combat jack, so I didn't hear actual words from anybody but Lou. Hello there. That was like a faint shout from a mile away. I focused my mind and shouted back. The calibration was almost automatic for those of us who'd been doing it for years, but we did have to stop and back up twice for Ralph, a Neo who joined us 2 cycles ago when Richard stroked out. It was just a matter of all 10 of us squeezing one muscle group at a time until the red thermometer matched the blue thermometer on the heads up. But until you're used to it, you tend to squeeze too hard and overshoot. After an hour, they opened the cage and unjacked us. We could kill 90 minutes in the lounge. It was hardly worth wasting time getting dressed, but we did. It was a gesture. We were about to live in each other's bodies for 9 days, and enough was enough. Familiarity breeds, as they say. Some mechanics become lovers, and
Sometimes it works. I tried it with Carolyn.